Hello. Oh, it's a bit loud. It's okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the mobility side of the Foresight Hydrogen Conference. Just checking you're all in the right place. My name is Diana Rain. I'm give you a little bit of background about me. I'm a consultant in the hydrogen space. I've been working in hydrogen energy for over 20 years. Spent a big chunk of my career at Air Products, and I left them when I was heading up the hydrogen energy business for Europe in 2016. So since 2016, I've been working freelance. I work a lot with companies, all different sizes of companies, from startups to multinationals, providing predominantly advisory support work. I sit on a number of advisory boards for companies either in the hydrogen space or looking to pivot into hydrogen. And I also do a fair bit of technical and commercial due diligence on investments, either in companies or in projects. Finally, the last thing I do is actually get my hands a little bit dirty sometimes. I work on some hydrogen projects. I'm working on two in Ireland, which are particularly challenged on the mobility side of things. So our role is to bring vehicles and infrastructure into the island of Ireland, and that has some, I think, challenges that are, I guess, fairly reflective of the industry as a whole. So that's me. We've got three sessions on mobility today. Each session will have four speakers. We are covering the entire kind of mobility value chain, infrastructure and vehicle providers. Each speaker will come and talk to you and share their insights, and then if you can hold questions to the end, we'll get everybody back up and we'll do a panel discussion at the end of each session. So hoping for lots of questions and lots of interaction to get the most out of the day. All the admin stuff's there. I don't think there's anything else I need to say except to invite Amanda Lyne, who's director of ULEMCO, who has probably been working in hydrogen even longer than me, which is saying something. So Amanda, come on up.
Diana, personally, some of you will know already in the audience, I got involved in hydrogen by founding a fuel cell technology, can't remember how long ago, certainly 20 years ago. And my current business, we're based in Liverpool City region, and I'll interface a little bit about us during the presentation. And I'm hoping to be a little bit controversial, although in some respects I know I'm probably in an audience where we're going to preach to the converted. So I hope at the end of my talk I've given you some of the ammunition to make the case for why hydrogen in transport is essential for us to deliver decarbonisation. Okay, so that's what I'm going to try and do at the end. So the history of ULEMCO. We've actually been going 11 years as a company. We've started up with just me and a wee bit of money from the local growth investment fund. Currently we're about to finish the completion of what we are providing as fleet-wide conversion to enable all of Aberdeen City Council's HGV fleet to have access to using hydrogen to displace diesel and therefore deliver CO2 reduction. During the course of what we do, that's the culmination of something like 50-something vehicles that will be on the road and enabled in hydrogen to save CO2 in that way. As a company, I'd arguably say we probably have the UK's most experienced team of folk knowing how you put hydrogen on board vehicles or other transport applications. We've done marine. The picture in front of you is non-road machinery, and that's a really key area, off-road machinery, a really key area that's developing as a demand that could be an early stage way of providing hydrogen usage. So the picture you see is actually at Brighouse, where there's some work going on. Those two excavators you can just see in the picture, have some hydrogen. That means they're displacing diesel. They're still using diesel, but every kilogram of hydrogen that they use, they will be saving CO2. So this is the bit that I think lets us all leave this session today, if we're interested and part of the hydrogen community, in helping folk understand why hydrogen is essential in heavy duty applications. The picture you can see is a road truck, but actually the principles behind what hydrogen can do in the decarbonisation story is the same in a whole variety of applications, where effectively, rather than having a vehicle off the road unproductive to charge, you can have fast fueling. In most cases, if the system is designed, that's pretty similar to what they do with diesel today. As a consequence, you get more range out of the way that the vehicle will operate. There are technologies and solutions going that mean that, you know, with one fuel event, you can get a lot further using hydrogen than you would with battery storage. Significantly on weight, for the heavy duty applications and heavy use applications, efficiency is not about the energy use molecule. It's the efficiency of the asset and the productivity of the asset. And in the case of, you know, heavy duty applications, large vans upwards, that's about the utility that you get out of the vehicle. And if you're using a significant proportion of the payload to cover the battery storage and the other parts of it, you're not actually making that vehicle productive. Although contentious, there's plenty of evidence and discussion that says using hydrogen instead of relying on scarce materials mined out of the ground around the world will ultimately be more environmentally friendly than relying on those technologies. So here's the controversial bit. When I speak to heavy-duty vehicle operators, or even for that matter, people that run taxi fleets and passenger cars that need to be running 24/7 and all the other things that they go, it becomes evident to me when I speak to the real users, not the academics, that battery electric technology cannot deliver the required performance in all the transport applications in the time for 2050. Okay, think about that. That's really what we believe. It may be that sometime in the future somebody comes with a revolutionary solid battery technology and all the other things that are promised. But when I speak to folk, people don't believe that that will happen in time. Recharging technology isn't viable in many applications because of the time it takes to charge. If you're running a fleet, you need to be able to use the vehicle, operate it, and use it when you want to do, not have it sitting there charging. It is not possible, in my view, across the globe, and certainly even in the UK, for us to build the necessary electricity network in all the places that we need to have hydrogen available in transport applications in time for 2050. There are decisions that can be made locally about how we gear up our investment in putting in charging infrastructure, but money is part of that story. And if there are ways that we can do this easier, of which hydrogen does, that's a fundamental thing. We have to remember that this target for climate emission has a timescale as well as a theory. The reality is, as I've alluded, battery electric solutions are not efficient use of our resources or the energy in many circumstances. So on paper, it is easy to make a case that says if you could connect an electricity grid that's fully renewable directly into charging a vehicle when they want to do it, that would be energy-wise efficient. Don't argue with that. The reality is we don't live in a world today that we use the most efficient way of doing stuff. And why should we imagine in this transition, not only are we going to move away from giving out greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is the point, what we're trying to do is stop them going into the atmosphere, because we're accumulating a budget worth of CO2 that's causing global warming, that we're going to then suddenly be doing that and improve efficiency. Now, there is certainly an argument that says if we can improve efficiency, the cost of this transition is better. So if we can do things efficiently and it makes it possible in the timescales that we've got it, by any means, let's try and do it. But the clock is ticking. And ultimately, why are we trying to do both at the same time? The biggest single thing that I fear hugely when we try to present a story that says battery electric technology is the solution is that organisations and behaviours will not keep pace for doing that for the timescales that we need to do it. We create so many barriers that actually are hidden that people are willing to acknowledge and take, right? Which are just going to be so slow. We all work in businesses that recognize trying to move this super tanker of the big business that we work in takes chuffing ages, right? If we create all these barriers into decarbonization, which is hard enough as it is, which is going to cost us more as a society, I can't see that super tanker moving in time. Hydrogen offers a way of minimising some of those impacts. It's not all, and that's the other thing in hydrogen, we shouldn't promise that it's exactly a drop-in replacement. But we should certainly ask the questions deeper about the wider implications. Now, the point is we can't do any of this in transport if we don't have refuelling. And this is a live picture of the places across Europe where you could get access to hydrogen refuelling. And I'll draw your attention to the UK, where frankly, at the moment, today, there's probably two places that anybody could actually fill up. When I set the company up in 2014, there was probably nearly a dozen. The consequence of us not having follow-on fundings to help support building that infrastructure is we now have less than two places that we can fill up rather than building a network similar to what is growing elsewhere in Europe. The other point in Europe is they are recognising the requirement to have infrastructure for hydrogen, to give people the choice for people to be able to get to that route. So, no hydrogen fueling. However, here's some exciting news in that. I've been, as you would imagine, a company trying to sell a technology that uses hydrogen. The most important people that I can collaborate with are the people that are investing in hydrogen infrastructure, production and everything else. They're my best friends, right? And we will collaborate with all of the people that want to invest in that. And in truth, those people are currently not in this room, they're in the room next door. So please make sure later that you communicate to them, okay? So this is my current view at the end of last year with the announcement of the three HAR1 projects that have been signed and funded, and also my discussions with a number of decent and proper developers that are looking to put hydrogen infrastructure into the system as an energy vector, but actually also to facilitate transport. So you can see we've probably got a couple of years of let's do some trials, get familiar, and we want to encourage OEMs and the folk that are wanting to launch hydrogen-available products and solutions in all parts of the demand, but that's my view based on talking to across the country of where the cohesive hubs of hydrogen production will be and then the rest of the supply chain associated. And what does that mean? Well, for Yalemco, we are here about trying to provide those customers that I've just talked about that actually own vehicles or operate machines with zero carbon innovative fuel solutions. In the short term, we have a technology that enables almost any diesel engine certainly to be enabled with hydrogen fuel use. We're also doing work in fuel cell technology to range extend electric technology because we know electric technology is developing. And we're also doing work in hydrogen combustion. In our case, what we're looking at is how we can use existing combustion engines, adapt them to work on 100% hydrogen, and combine that with an electric drivetrain that will enable repowering to give the most optimal solution. So I'm going to go through why. Here's some examples of essential. refuse trucks, right? You will hear the battery brigade tell you that refuse trucks can all be done by electric. They can't, right? If those refuse trucks are operating in rural, semi-rural areas with hills, at depots that can't get access to charging or anything else like that, they can't technically do, right? And the evidence is growing, which is great because people are trialing it and working out that it can't. And equally, actually, the councils can't afford the technology that's available today either. Any electric vehicle that's being offered for these types of applications are at least two, if not three times more expensive than what they currently pay for their diesel equipment. Some more examples of specialist applications where they use power takeoff on the vehicle and they use other forms of energy to contribute as well as the base load. Our exciting, and I'm going to show you a couple of pictures of things like the emergency services, where the vehicle needs to be ready to go. It's very productive, doesn't have any time to sit and do nothing. It needs to be parked in lots of places. It needs to be full. In most cases, it also is carrying a heavy weight, other forms of energy required on board the vehicle. Our second version, the ambulance you see, by the way, this isn't a CAD drawing, it is real. The second version of this is part of a project that we're delivering under the APC that will enable the upgraded version of this being demonstrated on the road in the next 18 months. This is a CAD drawing, and that's only because the body that we're putting the hydrogen and the fuel cell technology in is currently in production in Scotland, and will be down in our factory to install it. So it would be the world's first ever fully zero emission fire engine. And the interesting thing with this project is we're doing it because the customer asked us to. The fire brigade in Oxfordshire, or the fire service in Oxfordshire, worked out what we said, and they don't believe that they can do it with simply electric drivetrain. And critically, fire vehicles have to have 4 hours pumping time energy on board to certify it as a fire engine. So at the moment, the company in Scotland, Emergency One, that makes something like 80% of all the UK, 90% of the UK's fire engines, do a hybrid where they put a petrol engine in. Don't use it that often, but they have to have it. This is one of the Aberdeen City Council, but it highlights other applications in off-road machinery where access to refueling or electrical charging is going to be extremely challenging. These guys can do stuff with methane and biomethane and those kind of applications. That's not zero carbon, and ultimately it's not sustainable. So those kind of issues exist on the alternatives of methane. Now, if they use biomethane, in the welter wheel, it's better than what would have degraded as that waste go into the atmosphere without being used. They still put CO2 into the atmosphere. So hydrogen is better than biomethane or any form of biodiesel, particularly if we're using it in a combustion engine, because it's actually stopping that go to atmosphere. And that's what we're trying to do, stop the accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere. There's the picture of our tow tug operating. That's the one with our hybrid technology moving at airports and aircraft. And the excavators that I showed you earlier. So in principle for ULEMCO, the challenge for us or what we do is we're offering a practical solutions to decarbonisation that encourage folk to get involved and do hydrogen on a fleet-wide basis. Because the other thing that you will hear on battery electric technology is they can do one or two. In fact, Edinburgh City Council have just done a depot's worth of electric and they've put the infrastructure in. But when they went to try and look at another depot, they knew they couldn't get the electricity. And equally, using the most of the infrastructure they've already installed, the council said they couldn't afford it. So the challenge we're all trying to do is get people not to do ones and twos. They need to do fleets. And fleets also help them in ensuring that we can provide the hydrogen cost effectively as well. So that's me. And I'm obviously here. Do we take questions now, Diana, or do we? Okay, cool. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amanda. It's always good to see some real applications rather than drawings and theories, etc. So that's always good. Next up, we have Brad Miller, who's head of low carbon vehicle product and pricing at Vauxhall Movano Hydrogen Programme.
Good morning. My name is Brad Miller. I'm the head of LCVs at Vauxhall. And nothing controversial with what Amanda said. A lot of it we agree with. The, you know, Vauxhall and the parent company Stellantis have been number one BEV in both UK and Europe. But there is a need for a second solution, and that second solution is hydrogen. So, start with a video. This just shows the Movano hydrogen. Before I push the next slide, it's important. This slide is important. Vauxhall's been around for over 150 years. They've been making vehicles cars since 1903 and commercial vehicles since 1930. So we're going to be here next week. We're going to be here in 5 years. You know, there's a longevity to Vauxhall and us being involved in hydrogen. We're not a startup, and we've got bricks and mortar to support fleets who want to make that transition into hydrogen vehicles. So we've already announced pricing, so we're commercialising the Movano hydrogen. We've already announced pricing for that. Order banks will open soon. In fact, this week we've just ordered the first 15 vehicles. Serial production commences in Q3, and then first customer deliveries also in Q3 of this year. I mean, it was on the video, but do you know, the Movano hydrogen solution has no impact within the cargo capacity of the vehicle or the cargo itself. So on top of the EV motor is the fuel cell stack. You've got the EV motor there, which was shared with the other EV vehicles as well. You've got the battery, and I'll explain why we have a battery as well as the hydrogen tanks, and then the hydrogen tanks sit under the floor. It's a unique technology, and Opel, our sister company, have been developing this for almost 30 years, initially in cars, and then about 3 or 4 years ago, transitioned to this hydrogen technology into commercial vehicles. It's a blended power source. So when you start the vehicle, it starts with a battery as you start moving. Then the fuel cell kicks in, so you have this blended power source between the fuel cell and the BEV or the battery. And then when you're cruising, it's purely the fuel cell that's driving the vehicle. And then you've got brake regeneration also back into the battery. And what's important is the fuel cell recharges the battery and maintains it at a minimum level of 50%. If it drops to 35%, the driving mode will drop into eco, and it will siphon some of those kilowatts from the fuel cell into the battery to bring that back up to 50%. So these are the USP. Some of these were in the video. 311-mile combined range, tanks under the floor, so no impact to cargo capacity. Now, there are three main USPs to hydrogen. There are some other minor ones, but 5-minute filling time, and I've got a chart on this coming up. Hydrogen range, hydrogen is not impacted by cold weather, and hydrogen is not impacted by climate control, the use of climate control like in a battery electric, because the fuel cell creates heat, and that is also used to heat the cabin as well. And then I think Amanda touched on this one as well, is filling infrastructure can work when grid connections prohibit charger installation, and we already have a number of fleets that are struggling with this as well. So this is a BEV, and you can see that in cold weather and with a climate control on, you get a deterioration in range. And in fact, that's up to 29% between you know, mild at 20 degrees and no air conditioning, and versus, you know, a day like today when you've got the heating on as well, and that range deterioration is up to 29%. A fuel cell doesn't have any of that. It's not impacted by cold weather, and it's not impacted by the use of the heater. So it's a consistent range that doesn't have any seasonal variation. And then also, you know, the filling time as well. So, you know, you have to recognise that when you're doing rapid and ultra-rapid charging, the times that are quoted by all OEMs are only 80% of the range as well. Because after 80%, the battery, the charging will slow down, and it takes normally double that time to get to 100%. So on AC charging, you can see that, you know, charging up our largest of the EVs is quite slow. Whereas it doesn't even, on the same scale, you can't even see it. It's 5 minutes versus, I mean, on ultra rapid, it's 55 minutes. If you can find a rapid charger at 150 kilowatts that has a bay big enough to put a large van into it as well. So, you know, this is a significant USP for fleets. So there's no dead time through charging, and vehicles can be double shifted, which is, I mean, I left at 4 this morning to get here, and there was a lot of vans running through the night on the motorways to get here, and most of those are double shifted as well. You can't do that with a BEV. So we've got Vivaro, which is our medium-sized van. We've got a couple of these running around at the moment in, around Birmingham. Fleet trials are using these. Now, we're not going to, you can see some of the numbers over the side. The payload is consistent. Obviously, the difference is the filling time and that consistency of range. But I can't tell you what fleets have been driving it, but a number of fleets have driven it, and we've got a backlog of about 6 months of fleets wanting to trial the technology. We're not commercialising the medium van at this stage. So that's some more, well, you can actually see Centrica and British Gas on the side of that van, so they've liveried that one up as well. But yeah, most of the fleets are taking it for 4 to 6 weeks so they can get a real test of the technology and understand how it works for them. So this is the one that we are commercialising, is the Movana, which is the larger one. We think there's much more appetite and much more opportunity to do the larger van. You can see that the payload is relatively consistent within the 4.25, but the big difference is, of course, the range and the charging time there as well. So that's going to be commercialised as both left-hand drive and right-hand drive, and recognising different deadlines in the UK, this vehicle will be commercialised at the same time as a right-hand drive. Total cost of ownership is an important calculation when it comes to fleets. So we have announced pricing. Now, I'm not going to give you all the other OEMs on this list, but even with the list price, Movano has BEV competitors that have a higher list price than it does. So it sits well within the competitor set of EVs, and I think people were expecting this was going to be a multiplication of, in terms of cost, and it's not, because it's serial production. You know, we're not having to duplicate a powertrain, remove it, and put another one in. And the cost increment is, I think it's £18,000 is the difference between a BEV and a Movano hydrogen on list price. Not that anyone in the UK pays list price for a van these days anyway, but come and talk to James and he'll do you a deal from our fleet department. So this is total cost of ownership, and this is pence per mile on a four-year cycle, on a typical cycle. So just taking you through, on the left-hand side, you've got Movano ICE. So this is our model year 25 range, and this is at 160 a litre. You've got Movano BEV with 110 kilowatt hour battery, second there, the lowest of the columns, at 29p a kilowatt, which is what we use from ZapMap. Then you've got the public charge, so this is purely public charge Movano at 80p, again from ZapMap. You've got fuel cell there in the fourth column, and now that's the 23 pounds a kilo is currently what Heathrow and Tyresley are charging for a kilo. And then on the last column there is where we expect hydrogen to go through the decade down to 12 pounds a kilo. And by the time we get to 12 pounds a kilo, the fuel cost between a diesel and a hydrogen is very similar. Now, in that middle column, there is a black bar at the bottom, and that's downtime. And this is what a lot of fleets are struggling with, because you've got take Centrica, who've taken our vehicle, and they've been quite public about this as well, is that in the middle of winter, when they're the busiest, they're finding that some of their engineers are spending 2 to 3 hours in a Morrison's car park charging their vehicles. You know, they're unionised, they can't get that time back, and they're taking it, you know, they're considering that to be a loss in revenue as well in this charging time. And you have to take that into consideration within a, I guess, within a unionised working week as well. So there is a bit of a black bar in the others, not obviously on the overnight BEV. And I mean, what this graph shows you is that if you can overnight charge a BEV, that is the right thing to do. That's the most economic thing. But if you've got any reliance on public charging, the equation starts to change. So yeah, as the trend expectation is that we, low carbon hydrogen production increases, you'll start to see a reduction in the price of hydrogen. You will never get parity on a TCO, but you will get parity on a fuel cost. I think this is my last chart. This just shows the mandate, which is the dotted line. The grey shows this decrease in diesel as we go towards 2030. The dark red is the BEV, and you can see the fuel cell growing through the decade as well. You know, I think our expectation is on the large van, which makes up about 35% of the UK market. Probably about 10-15% of that will be fuel cell by the end of the decade. So I guess, as Amanda alluded to, there's nothing she said that was controversial at all, really, but there are some operational conditions that just don't work on BEV. And we are, you know, we've got, there's no lack of interest in our vehicles. There is a, you know, concern about infrastructure, but there's a few people here to talk about it. The black bar is an estimate of where we think filling stations would be. So somewhere between 100-140 maybe by the end of the decade is kind of, talking to all the key players, that's kind of where we think it'll be. I think that's a fairly realistic viewpoint of where filling stations will be by the end of the decade. And that's it. I am around today if you've got any questions, if you want to do a deal. James from Fleet Department's here as well, and you can come and have a chat with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. Good to never miss a sales opportunity. Yeah. Next up, we have Ian Thompson, who's the CTO of H2X.
Well, hello everyone. I'm not too sure how many people know H2X. We were here presenting last year. I wasn't actually here myself. I was actually in India, but I was Skyped in through the time I was here last time. I'd also like to thank Amanda and Brad there, because you're going to justify basically what I'm going to say now, which helps. I was wondering if this would have been rather awkward if I started talking about a strategy that we did that doesn't fit with what everyone else is doing in the marketplace. So I've been in the automotive industry since 1985, started way back in with Rover. Most of my time I've been developing high-end luxury vehicles, spent a lot of time with Lotus, a lot of time with Aston Martin. So the last 6 or 7 years, probably 10 in total, I've been working on hydrogen and ICE vehicles. So it's better retribution for the damage I've probably done for the first part of my career. The challenge we had with starting up H2X, we started back in 2020 with the two founders, Brendan and Chris Wrights. I started with them back in China as well, back in the early 2019 with a company called Grove, which was a hydrogen startup company. The challenge was in 2019, we were in China, obviously. The biggest problem, we were in a city called Wuhan, which wasn't famous at the time, but became rapidly famous very soon after that. So the problems that all went wrong in 2019 with the COVID, and we all had to move out. So then we started up our own company in 2020. Probably not a great time to start either, but it was that or nothing really for the time. So we wanted to make our own way into the marketplace. So for the first year, it was basically Skype interviews and talks with people all over the world, trying to work out what was the best market. So we looked at there's all over the world. You've got the US market, the South American market, Europe, Asian markets, all of them doing different things. Some are doing BEV, some are doing ICE, some are doing hydrogen ICE, some are now doing hydrogen FCEV. So we were trying to work out for the longest time what was the best vehicle to work in, because there's been so many startups in this industry, unfortunately, start up well and have good investment, but just not be able to make it from that point forward. So we didn't want to be one of those going stuck on that marketplace. So we decided to look into, we had to ask ourselves some questions. What is the global availability of hydrogen refueling? What's the planned availability of hydrogen refueling? What's currently out there in the market? And what's the current market focus and available options that we don't really want to end up competing too much with? So looking into this, we first of all say, well, okay, let's look at the markets. So first big market, US market. So availability of hydrogen refueling in the US. Great if you live in California, or great if you live in the Northeast. Pretty much nothing in between. So this was a problem with a chance. We thought, well, maybe the expansion of in the US is going to be good. Not really. They're not really planning a lot going forward either. So unless you're in California or pretty much the small Northeast corner of the US, the marketplace wasn't there for us at the moment. So we decided that the US was not a place to go. And then we look at the availability of hydrogen in Europe. Lots of it available. Not so much in the UK as we've noticed at the moment, but Europe is very much a focus on this, and especially the Scandinavian countries are growing quickly with it too. And to look at that for the, what's the growing planned availability, it's even more. So obviously, the focus for the market was the European market. We looked into the Asian market. Now, China and North and South Korea, doing good. Pretty much the rest of Asia, not really there. China is a very difficult market to get in anyway. They pretty much developed their own vehicles and their own platforms, so it wasn't really there. Same with South Korea. You've got a lot of Hyundai is doing a lot of work out there, so there wasn't really a market. And again, the growth didn't seem to be a lot. China does tend to be focusing a lot more for BEV at the moment. Taking from that, we thought, okay, we are an Australian company, basically. So we thought, well, okay, what's in our home country? Forget that. There's nothing out there in hydrogen at all. And planning was really not long either. So from this, we thought, okay, so the main market to focus on is obviously is the European market. Then we need to look at, okay, well, what's the market adoption? How many people are taking fuel cell vehicles? What's the volume out there? It's really, we were looking at this in the region of 10, so it's around the 12,000 vehicles a year, which is not a lot, but so this gave us an idea of what we need to focus on product-wise. I mean, it's very difficult for us to develop a brand new vehicle when that's your volume globally. It's really, I mean, to make a brand new vehicle, a brand new platform, you'll never make the money back. So that was one of the things we want to focus on for that. So what we want to look at is, do we develop our own new vehicle, or do we develop something that's based off of what we call a retrofit? So it's basically using a standard vehicle, taking out the standard drivetrain, retrofitting it, and going into that market. With that, we then look into what was the breakdown all over the world. So if you look at this, Republic of Korea has a lot. But again, that's a lot of it's the Hyundai Nexo and the Hyundai truck vehicles. US has quite a large amount, but that's basically your Toyota Mirai, your Hyundai Nexo, and your Honda Clarity. and maybe a couple of trucks and buses. China is pretty much nearly all buses and small trucks. Japan, obviously, is your Toyota and your Hondas. And then the European thing, you've got around 4,300 vehicles. There was a bit of a miss out on this because for some reason I missed out Spain, Poland and Finland and that, and the Czech Republic. But if you add those together, it's like 15 vehicles. Really doesn't move the target by much. So from these adoptions and vehicles, we said that the European market seems to be where to go. And obviously not going to markets where we can sell to customers. So the customer market wasn't really there. So what we looked at from that was where's the share of vehicles. So you can see a large one on the left, it's very high in passenger vehicles. And again, that's your Toyota Mirai, your Hyundai Nexo, your Honda Clarity. Then you've got the share by continent. If you look, the large blue one is Asia. But again, that's buses and small trucks and some of their own vehicles. But so where do we look at? We're looking at the medium trucks. Heavy trucks we have a problem with because of the network. At the moment, the network isn't really there for heavy trucks, for what we call the prime movers. But for back-to-base operations and for fleet operations, which are working from a certain location, which is what we've been mentioned before, that seems to be a very good target area for where we want to aim for. Just looking at what the market available out there at the moment, there's been many others, but every time I kept writing this, they'd either go out or come back in and the company would disappear. So these are obviously the key ones that everyone knows in the market at the moment. And of course, obviously now the Vauxhall one, which is based off the Stellantis platform. With this one shows you the current market basically for China. And if you look at it, it's pretty much all commuter buses, passenger buses, or highway passenger vehicles. There's very little on cars. So the Chinese market wasn't really one for us to focus on. So summary. So the USA, Europe, and Asia markets are the largest. Europe and Asia is the largest growing refueling. The focus appears to have been on passenger cars, buses, and HTV. China is very focused on commercial vehicles and buses in the FCV market anyway. USA refueling is very focused in California and a little in the northeastern states, but pretty much nothing in between. Europe has the best density of refueling and growing. And the network is really not ready yet for passenger vehicles or prime movers at this point in the marketplace, apart from Europe. But it's growing, and it's growing in there. But if we were going to be working as a company developing a product, it would be no good us bringing out a version of a Mirai or something like that, because one, we're competing with our supplier of fuel cells, and two, you know, they've been doing it for 20 years now, so it wasn't really a marketplace for us. So with this is the strategy we decided to work on. So the main focus was to work on the European market due to the growing network and the better spread out. The product focus is on the back-to-base fleet operations, ED, municipalities, last-mile delivery companies, water, gas, electric companies, anywhere where they basically their fleet comes out from a base operations. Because they'll base that operations, they can either put a refueling station on site, or they'll be based near a refueling station. And this way, those cars are running 24/7. So as we've already been talking before, BEVs were not really an option for that due to the fact that they have a major recharging time. We looked into whether we base a new vehicle or whether we went to a retrofit. So we decided to go with the retrofit option. This way we take a standard vehicle, retrofit it, and sell it back to the customer in the marketplace. This gets us development costs down, the speed to market, and it's a better known platform to the customer. So even though we're swapping out the fuel, so the engine, the ICE engine, we're still keeping the brakes, the interior components, the body components of a standard vehicle. So the customers can go to the standard OEMs shop to get the standard parts, and we supply anything for the fuel cell side. And long term, we have to look at long term too. We are developing our own platform, and there's a key platform which is what we looked at is the van platform, which is very popular in that marketplace. So this is what we looked at as platform. So we're starting out with our what we call the Warrego. This is basically a Ford Ranger, retrofitted. We talk with a lot of customers in this marketplace, and a lot of these fleet companies utilize pickup trucks. So there's not really an option for a pickup truck out there, apart from Toyota, who have now just started with the Hilux. So we got the Warrego, which is the first one out there. And then, as we've been talking with Amanda was talking earlier, garbage trucks are a big market. We have two customers in Sweden, who are municipalities for Gothenburg and for Malmo, and those guys are looking in. We're looking into putting into hydrogen fuel cell gas trucks for them. Then we're looking at the large vans and the 3.5 ton, 5 ton vehicles. Basically for what we call last mile delivery or for your fleet service vehicles. And then there's the last one you'll see is our own developed vehicle. This is with the Darling platform. This is a light van which has been designed purely as a hydrogen vehicle. This is not a hydrogen range extender. This is a pure hydrogen vehicle with no battery pack. It goes straight with the hydrogen fuel cell in supercapacitors. So we do not use a battery pack. This one just gives you an idea of the layout we've done and developed for it. So you can see that there's a fuel cell with tanks, and the vehicle has been designed from ground up as a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, not a modified version of a standard existing vehicle. And that's basically our long-term view for the platform for it, and how we came up with our strategy for what we do for H2X. Afterwards this, I'll take any questions on it as well. But thank you very much for your time.
So three presentations focusing on the vehicle aspects. The next presentation is from Chloe Tyndale, who's the Hydrogen Marketing Business Development Manager at Air Products. So hopefully we're going to hear something on the infrastructure side.
Hello, everybody. So I didn't plan for where I was going to put the iPad, so I'll pop that down there. My name is Chloe Tyndale, I'm from Air Products, and I'm here to talk to you today about enabling hydrogen through infrastructure. So for those of you who don't already know who Air Products is, this is a very brief introduction to say hydrogen has been a part of Air Products for many, many years, 70 plus years. So we already have hydrogen plants all over the world, we already have electrolyzers, we already have pipelines, and we are the world's largest hydrogen producer today. So we know a thing or two about hydrogen, and now it's really exciting to see it deployed into different markets where we previously have not had a market to deploy it to. So these are some of the markets that we have been supplying hydrogen to over the years. So in the 1950s, we supported the NASA space race with hydrogen to fuel those rockets. In the 1980s, it moved across to the prevention of the acid rain movement. And then as you can see in the 2000s, that's when it really started to talk through mobility applications. And that's where you've heard of our Heathrow facility being mentioned a couple of times this morning. That's when that got installed in 2012 for the London Olympics. So even now, it's been 10 plus years of us working with hydrogen for mobility applications. And it's exciting now to think about what the 2020s and beyond will bring for these applications and more. So these are just some of the pictures of mobility applications worldwide to show that Air Products has a variety of experiences with a variety of buses, trucks, trains, cars. As you can see in the top corner here, I've highlighted in green, Heathrow is the one here with the car, and our Crawley facility has got the bus in that picture there. So we'll go into a little bit more detail about those specific applications later, but for now, look at the pictures. But I'm here today to talk about how we do this, because it's nice and pretty to have the pictures up there to show what exists, but how do we actually make that possible today? So there's a few things. We've got safety to consider, we've got supply to consider, and we've also got solutions to consider. So we'll start with safety. Safety is number one. And because Air Products has been operating hydrogen for years, we have a lot of experience with hydrogen safety. But that hydrogen safety has mainly been used on production facilities, big scale industrial plants, chemical productions. And so the safety standards at these places, they're very rigorous, they're very known. Adding hydrogen to that is normal. As we transition to use hydrogen in a lot of these new applications, and the mobility space is one of those new applications, we need to make sure that these learnings and this expertise from these big industrial applications gets transferred across. Because there will be knowledge gaps. There'll be knowledge gaps from the people operating the pump to go and connect it to the car, the bus, or the van, or the truck. They need to learn the slight differences. It's mainly the same, but they need to learn the nuances that exist. And there's going to be differences in terms of the modeling of how does this fuel behave differently to how diesel behaves. And so it's really making sure that we understand the hydrogen use and how it can be distributed, stored, applied, so that everybody stays safe. So a little plug here, I actually sit on the BCGA Hydrogen Committee, and the BCGA, for anybody who hasn't heard of them, is the British Compressed Gases Association. They're the ones who've been writing the standards for how to use nitrogen, argon, oxygen, hydrogen for years. So they're the ones that have all the expertise. Our company, our competitors, we all sit on this table where we share learnings, we share knowledge, we share issues, challenges, and we learn from them. So anybody who wants to know more about safety in hydrogen or any other gases, go to these guys, they're the experts. So then we move on to supply. And just a quick note here on Air Products' global supply network for hydrogen. So as I say, we've always been producing grey hydrogen historically, but now we need to move across to the energy transition, and that'll be linked in with green hydrogen production and blue hydrogen production globally. But that's what Fred is talking about next door on the production side. So I'll just have a little post here about NEOM is our flagship green production facility in Saudi Arabia that will be producing up to 600 tons of hydrogen. It's actually 60% complete already, so it's not just a piece of paper. There will be 600 tons of hydrogen coming from this facility. But I'm here to talk about what that means for the UK. And so what we do in the UK is we'd be able to have Immingham Renewable Hydrogen Facility. So what would happen is we've got ammonia tanks. We've got an ammonia tank there, you can see. And an ammonia ship would come in from our facility in Saudi Arabia with the renewable ammonia on board. That would then enable 320 gigawatt hours of energy storage in that 55,000 litre ammonia tank. So the energy on the site is dispatchable on demand because it's sitting there ready to go through the facility to be produced into hydrogen. We'd then dissociate the ammonia into hydrogen, and at maximum capacity, we could create 210 tons a day of hydrogen, which is equivalent to about 300 megawatts of power, which is about 3% of the UK's target by 2030. So I think we've got the hydrogen supply bit sorted, but what we get asked a lot is, that's great if you live next door and you've got a truck that wants to fuel there, but what do we do if we're not next door? What do we do if we've not got an electrolyzer facility on our doorstep, or this facility on our doorstep? How do we actually get the hydrogen? Well, that's the good bit, because we've been distributing hydrogen for years in various forms. So we can have everything from a tiny little cylinder of any of our gases, all the way up through these modes of supply that's suitable for whatever site or requirement you guys have. So you've got the gaseous supply at the small end. You can have your individual cylinders, or you can bundle those cylinders together. For majority of what trucks and buses and vans would require, you'd need at least these maxi packs where you'd have cylinders manifolded together in a pack. These can be stacked high or stacked next to each other as well. Well, there becomes a point where you'd have to give up your whole yard to have maxi packs next to each other. So at that point, the next size up of supply mode is a tube trailer. And in a tube trailer, you can hold hydrogen at a variety of pressures. So you can start with a 200 bar trailer that holds around 400 kilograms. You can go up 300, 500. We've actually got a 640 bar trailer in development as well. So all of these advancements in technology and developments of our existing tube trailer fleet mean that we can store more and more hydrogen in a tube trailer to deliver to your site wherever you'd need it. That's what we do with Heathrow today. Then you probably have an expanding fleet, a growing need. This is where the liquid supply comes in. So with liquid hydrogen, you can actually store three times as much hydrogen as if you were going to do it in a gaseous form. So if you're planning ahead to converting a whole fleet or even part of a fleet, the liquid hydrogen option on your facility means that you have reduced footprint. You don't need 15 tube trailers lined up next to each other. You can simplify your logistics because you don't need tube trailers coming in every single day. You can have one delivery a week, one delivery every 2 weeks, and you've got your dispatchable on-demand liquid hydrogen from your tank. And you can also minimize your power demand because you don't need to compress any of the hydrogen if you've got the compressionless systems. So liquid supply is something that Air Products is really looking into to develop further for these large-scale fleets that are going to convert. And as I talk a little bit later on about Crawley, that's the option they went for with Metrobus because they had the foresight that they were going to grow and they were going to do more than just a couple of buses here and there. They've got a good amount of buses converted and this is the solution that they went for. Obviously, a pipeline connection could also work if you're right next to a facility. Nice and simple, you don't have to think about any logistics. And then I'll just touch on the on-site generation piece. If you're lucky enough to have the land, the power, the water available in your site, and you need demand that is bigger than liquid supply or bigger than gaseous supply, that could also be an option for you. What we offer in those scenarios is the same offering for our nitrogen or our oxygen generators. Put the system on your site, and we put a liquid tank next to it so that if and when you need to maintain the generator, if it goes down, if renewables are intermittent, that's okay, your site doesn't go down because you've got the backup tank next to it. So all of these things, we discuss with whoever wants the supply on their site to find the best solution for them and make sure it matches up nicely so that we're selling you the right solution for what you need. So this is then looking at our HRS case studies. So as we touched on previously, we've got Heathrow and Crawley sites in the UK. Heathrow has been providing hydrogen, as we've heard today, for a variety of trials, for a variety of vehicles. It can fuel things from a car all the way up to a bus or a truck. So it is there. If anybody wants to do any trials, if anybody wants to use it, do reach out. We've got Ian, who I think is in the other room. He will be happy to set you up with an account to be able to use that. We've also got Crawley, the Metro bus opportunity. So we provide liquid, as I've touched on there. They've got 54 hydrogen buses at that facility. That's why they needed this liquid supply. And our HRS offering was future-proofed for that demand. We've got multiple refueling spots on their site, and they've got the potential to convert their entire fleet. So what I will say with the Crawley Metro bus opportunity, before I touch on our European ones, is that we've got Ed Willis from Metrobus himself, who featured on our podcast, talking about how this came about, the work that we've done together, Air Products and Metrobus, to get the facility on stream, operational, and get his buses running. And I also saw at the weekend he'd put a post on LinkedIn about the successes that we're now seeing with the facility operating his buses, and he's just got his new buses, and he's operating more and more. So don't take my word for it that the liquid hydrogen site was working. Go listen to Ed. And then we're looking across Europe. I thought I had a map in here about showing, very similarly to what you've seen earlier, that Europe is ahead of us. There are many more refueling stations in Europe, and like was touched on earlier, that's because there's more funding available, there's more demand required. They've got AFIR regulations, they've got RED 3 that requires a lot more action today. So that's why you see a lot of the deployment of capital to go and build refueling stations where the demand is. The UK needs to work together now to mean that we can also do that and we can build the refueling infrastructure in the UK so that we can then seed the demand so that we can enable all of these buses, trucks, vans to be refueled. So just touching on Hearth as our German site, we already have Hearth 1 operational. That's a 350 bar facility. But we've got Hearth 2 that is under construction today. And if this works, there should be this video. It's always difficult when somebody plays a video. Any more of this. I think the end of the video goes on to show the construction that's happening and also the fact that this is a partnership with the European Commission. So that goes to show that the infrastructure that's able to be put in, the diggers are on site, they're actually making this happen. That comes with working in partnerships with governments, with customers, with developers. And so actually, what my plea was going to be next is we can work together in the UK. Let's find those locations like Hearth where we've got the logistics hubs in a certain area where they can start with the back-to-base refueling. Let's work out where a good location would be for that and let's start making the plans in place to get another refueling station in the UK. So that's what I'll leave you with here, that our higher purpose is to bring people together to collaborate and innovate solutions to the world's most significant and environmental sustainability challenges. So we need to work together. We need to make sure that we can make it possible to have new refueling stations that are safe, that are operational, that are reliable, and that can refuel the buses, trucks, trains, vans, whatever it is that we need to fuel with hydrogen. So thank you.
This one?
Oh.
This one is?
That one. I don't know if this one is or not. I'm just going to, first of all, open the floor to any questions from the audience. Do we have any? Yes. So is there a mic?
Yeah.
Could you just say your name and where you're from? That would be helpful. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. You heard of Lethbridge from ACAP Ventures. So I just want to understand, in terms of fleet, the market, if there was an availability of, let's say, Amanda, it looked like a ton a week or something would do a fleet for you. If you had that guaranteed supply, what is stopping the investment or the uptake in wider councils other than Aberdeenshire, for example?
Nothing. It's just they don't believe. I haven't seen it. Haven't actually had the chance to have fuel pricing that matches what the requirement will be. So if I take the work happening in the Glasgow area associated with the HAR1 project from Scottish Power, It is only this Christmas that Scottish Power have had the support to help them get the production. It will take them nearly 18 months or so to put in place the actual physical system to be able to supply the fuel. So over the next 18 months, Scottish Power are looking to negotiate fuel supply to customers in a suitable area from there. But they've only just been able to get to a point where they've got a business model that they know they can supply a competitive price.
So can I just check, Amanda, that is all to do with the HAR1 projects that have been announced? HAR2, I guess, everybody's waiting for, which are, I'm sure everybody knows they're the hydrogen production support mechanisms. Is that what you're saying?
Certainly in that case, yes. The base load in the early stages for hydrogen in transport at the moment is still quite small scale. So the Air Products model for the buses, you can get a very specific set of fleet that will commit to the demand. If you go a bit wider, largely at the moment, people don't buy fuel on a long-term contract as if they're taking 15 years worth of supply. So Scottish Power, as an example, if they want to do transport fuel and put it there, have to get a base load that's associated with the contract terms that are required for the production model. So at the moment, the base load production will be subsidised to displace industrial heat, industrial energy applications. But the benefit for them going into transport will actually enable them to make more value out of that investment than the price that they will get for supplying as energy in there. But the dynamics for delivering a refueling infrastructure is the chicken and egg challenge. And today, that's not how people buy fuel.
Can I add a little bit to that as well? It's, like you say, very much it worked for the Metrobus application because they were ready to make the decision. They were ready to say, we are going to convert X amount of our fleet, and so we need a long-term solution for this. What we need to do to work together as an industry now is to actually group demand. So where we've got a few locations where we've got a couple of customers converting a couple of trucks, buses, vans in certain locations, if we've got an area where they all come together where actually the risk for each individual company is then lower, then you can have a refueling infrastructure that each one can take from, but nobody's had to get the sole infrastructure themselves. So that's where we're trying to work out in the, who in the market is ready to work together and make some take some risk that you'd be transitioning to a fuel, but not the whole risk yourselves for the whole infrastructure.
I mean, we were talking recently with one of the key fleet people is people like your water boards. It looks like if you get some of these fleet companies who have got a vision with them, I mean, we were talking with the Thames Water. Thames Water got a vision with the fact that they are a water company, so they have the base material for making hydrogen on site themselves. So that's the kind of thing you need, is someone who's looking out. So they were looking at now updating their fleet going forward to hydrogen vehicles because it made sense to them, because they have a base, the base material to make the product from. So those are the kind of things we need to see, is a bit more innovation in the world and thinking about not just the fact that you're going to swap to hydrogen vehicles or to BEVs, but what's the full time of your company? What, you know, if you make water or you're creating hydrogen somewhere, why not move to hydrogen vehicles?
I guess in answer to the question, there's no lack of appetite for hydrogen commercial vehicles, and I'm quite glad that I'm not on stage with another OEM that we have to be apologetic about, because, you know, with Stellantis, we don't see that there's really a need for hydrogen cars, and so we're not working, you know, we've got no future plans for hydrogen cars, we're just working on commercial vehicles. And I think I gave you a stat at the end, that probably by the end of the decade, and that medium van, probably 5-10% will be hydrogen, and on the larger van, maybe as high as 20%. So if you look at the market, I mean, this last year was the first year of the mandate, and the market is split between small, medium and large, 30, 35, 35, you know, generally. But if you look at the BEV uptake, it was all biased towards small and medium, and there's a lack of appetite for fleets to take large vans because there's such a operational compromise, which is, we've had no shortage in interest in the hydrogen, but it goes back to if we had a pound for every time anyone said it, but, you know, it's this chicken and egg thing. So, and that's where we are. If there were 100 filling stations, we would have a very healthy order bank for hydrogen vans at the moment. There's no doubt about that, because on a TCO model, they're already starting to work. And there are, I mean, Amanda touched on it, there are some issues with BEVs that are, you know, systematic in terms of the infrastructure that, you know, people, we're not going to overcome. So you need to have, you need to have two solutions to achieve the zero emission, you know, future that we in transportation. So I guess there's no lack of appetite. It's filling stations. But what I would say about filling stations, I guess it's not one in one area. That's not going to work either. There has to be multiple. It's better to saturate one area with a number of filling stations and do it that way. So like Tees Valley or the High Haul program in Wales, where you've got multiple stations, because if one goes down, which is the issue we have at the moment with our fleet trials, is that Tyresley was down for maintenance, and unfortunately yours is down at the moment as well. So it makes it, and if you're relying on one filling station, it makes it quite difficult. So you need to have you need to have multiple choices within an area, and that's what will then, you know, drive the appetite and move forward with hydrogen. So what a pence per mile that includes, like a vehicle as a service. We've had a look at that, and it's difficult because trying to combine all that within, because it doesn't just stop there. Then you have to include insurance and maintenance and licensing and training. And there is a couple in truck as a service that have in US, but I don't think anyone's been successful at getting to work and Volta, who've gone under and then come back again. That was their model as well, was truck as a service, where you paid whatever it was, a couple of pounds, and that got you everything. But it's difficult to, you have to consolidate everything it involves a lot of people, to a lot of parties to do that.
I think you're changing too much as well. You know, the guys want to come to you to buy a van and they want to know what the cost of that is, and you're just about helping them to understand the downtime implications. But asking them to then buy from one fuel supplier as well is just way beyond. They don't do that. They buy fuel from wherever they want it, and they want a fuel card, and they want the things that go with it. So in my experience over the last few years, I felt that that model pushes it way too far.
And the reason we started looking into that actually was for 4.25 ton vehicles, because on the BEV, if you want payload and range, you've got to go into the N2 category, and you know, that has other implications. And we tried to, now there's obviously a consultation out, so hopefully that goes through, but that we were trying to make all that simple. And even that doesn't have fuel in it, because we weren't going to include charging in it, but even that's complicated. So, and then to add fuel on top of that, I mean, it's a utopian kind of situation, but it's just difficult to bring everything together.
I've got on the TCO thing, and just a comment made before about how we build the infrastructure economically. The truth is, in our dual fuel technology, the backup is diesel, actually. So it doesn't actually matter if the single hydrogen station goes down. What matters is they end up not saving CO2, which is obviously the justification for the investment in the first place. But actually, we delivered 20 gritters to Glasgow City Council just after COVID, and those vehicles have never run in hydrogen because nobody sorted out supplying them the hydrogen that was intended and promised and done in that way, right? The truth is, the City Council didn't really lose a lot because they've still been able to grit the roads the last two winters. So, you know, we can think out of the box a little bit, and the industry could work together a little bit more to make it understood that dual fuel and that technology that we have is a way of mitigating some of that challenge too.
Do we have any other questions? Yeah. Sorry, it's on this way.
Sorry, Mark Lewis, Tees Valley Combined Authority. Just a question. Wouldn't mobile refueling be an answer to the meeting the low levels of demand we're going to start with? And could that be made to work before we start installing large numbers of permanent stations?
Not for us, because we need 700 bar, and mobile refueling is not 700 bar. And people are just going to be focused on range anxiety, because you're only going to get half the range out of a hydrogen vehicle. So, you know, we've had a couple of fleets who've asked us, well, we'll get a mobile in, and can we use your vehicles? I mean, we're not really interested, because you're losing the ability to focus on the technology and what the technology can do if all you're looking at is the range that's now halved out of the vehicle.
But I was thinking maybe some technology development could give us 700 bar mobile refueling. I mean, why is that not possible?
Yeah, so we do have a mobile refueler. We take that at the moment to trials all over the country and all over Europe. But, I mean, it's been used for trials for buses, trucks, trains, but also for maritime, where we can actually pick it up. We can refuel at a certain maritime docking spot. Then they can set off on their venture. We take it to the next docking spot for them, and then they can continue to use it as they go. So the technology can be adaptable, and we can take it to where it is needed. And it could be something that you look at if you're wanting to deploy a trial for a short period of time. But what you still need is the infrastructure for the supply. You could take a tube trailer with you that you could dock at the site to refuel, but if you're going to require large volumes, you'd need the permanent liquid installation. So it could be something, and we do it. We work with installations, and we work with companies who want to deploy a mobile refueler. So if you think that could be something that would work for you, then do reach out. We see if it is possible in that scenario. But we probably can't deploy mobile refuelers everywhere in the hope that then everywhere will want to use 20 of these things. And then actually, if they all do convert to permanent, what do we do with 20 mobile refuelers? It still takes some CapEx. So with the ones that we've got, we can get a few, and we can work with companies to make it happen. But we need to have people who are willing to look to the future and plan ahead to the permanent installations and where those locations will need to be. Again, we can develop, whether it is all in the southeast, whether it is all in the north, that west, whatever it is, we can build the infrastructure, but we need to have the supply side and the demand side meeting in the middle.
Yeah, let's Let's describe what we're talking about, refueling infrastructure. Okay, so the first bit is you need to make the molecule, which is what we were talking about, the production lines. The best and most likely chances at the moment is the molecule's going to be made where it's sensible to make that molecule, not where vehicles and everybody else need it. Okay, so Whiteley Wind Farm, it's actually going to be right on the top of the mountain, the hillsides off the M74 on the left-hand side. Okay, so Scottish Power are organising a process that takes it off the hillside. So they will be mobile in terms of taking the production off there. What vehicle users need is to get a full load, like Brad is talking about, whether that's 700 bar or 350 bar, depending on what fills the tank, which requires some form of compression or high pressure supply into the equipment, okay? So ultimately, actually, the business model that we see says there's a mix of the nature of refueling infrastructure. There is something very different to a public big station that Brad customers are going to need, frankly, because that's what they do already today, to actually what maybe a back-to-base fleet might want, which, by the way, today they have some forms of fuel supplied and stored on-site and doing those kind of applications. And all of those technologies apply. Every aspect of what we're doing is a capital investment. So if you can put more hydrogen per whatever you're doing into that point and sell it, then you will make a cheaper price for the hydrogen to supply. So you can do one-offs, you can do demonstrations, but funnily enough, that doesn't mean that you have competitive to diesel-priced hydrogen.
And I think to also add on the point there that you were saying about the putting the infrastructure in place where you require it, and linking to the previous point that we can't just have one fuel station here, one fuel station there, one fuel station there, because everybody then has to do back to base forever, and you can't refuel on the move. But could we start with that? That actually we could start with some back to base in certain locations, get hydrogen started, then we can start seeing the demand and the supply go up together and build from there to have the confidence to deploy the next level of capital. And then, like we said, we've built one very good station that has the right level of cost and price because we've been able to do it in an economic way. And you can build that model as you go, rather than scattergunning quite expensive different things everywhere and hoping that they all get used. That's not going to build confidence in the market.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Tony Godfrey. I work in clean energy for the Welsh Government. So I think I'm already Amanda's best friend. I think you were in Wales quite recently, weren't you? Yeah. So my question is, panel members have all talked about our Hyhaul programme we'll be installing for refuelers across the M4 corridor in South Wales, which is a massive thing that we've been looking at for about the last 10 years. But one of the things that really intrigues me, when you're talking about off-road vehicles, particularly people like JCB, who've invested a huge amount of money into hydrogen ICE vehicles, I was just wondering what the thought process is. If you've got a vehicle which is going to different locations for a certain amount of time and then moves on somewhere else, what the medium-term thinking is for how that's going to be refueled in the future.
Brilliant question.
I think I'll come again. Thank you.
Yeah, well done. Where do we start? One particular comment, actually, is JCB are obviously well known for doing hydrogen combustion. And I will put the point that says, in the horses for courses argument, widening out the use of hydrogen in which powertrain is doing is inevitably going to happen. And some of the benefits of hydrogen combustion is that ultimately, I think the vehicles itself will be cheaper, right? So it is pretty well documented that you'll be putting a hydrogen engine in to put instead of a diesel engine, and the cost impact on that is small because you're using an engine technology that's already there. and you probably just add in the cost for having the hydrogen part of it, which is clearly more expensive than a plastic diesel tank or whatever happens today. So that aside, the answer on off-road machinery at the moment is we're in our excavator project. The key partners in that are plant hire companies, right? In the UK, we're probably quite different than some of the other places. More than 80 or 90% of the assets that are used in these construction projects and things are actually hired in. And actually, that does give a model for the hire companies to find a mechanism to hire it alongside some form of hydrogen supply, which is a bit more similar to what Brad is talking about. You would buy a package that does it. And in fact, TCP do it a bit like that for tower lights at the moment. So I think there's some options there. Our own company and JCB and others are adapting proper mobile refueling that enables actually the hydrogen to go to the piece of equipment rather than the equipment having to go to the refueling station, and that gives the flexibility. Fundamental, none of it's going to work if somebody doesn't make the clean hydrogen, low carbon hydrogen molecule somewhere and enable some kind of range of technologies of which we're all quite familiar and have experience of that can take the hydrogen from some production point and have it located in an area for the period of time that the hydrogen is going to need. In the Victoria Square project and the Brickhouse site, the hydrogen comes in a tube trailer type facility. It's used in a generator set from GeoPura, and they have a very small hydrogen refueling facility that the excavators can go to and fill up. And by the end of this month, we'll also be demonstrating our own sort of refueler that will then be the equivalent of a Bowser that they would currently use on the site. So take the hydrogen to the machine in its location.
Lloyd Mitchell, National Gas. Thanks for the really insightful presentations this morning. I was just wondering, we were talking about the use cases for the fleets. We're often talking about cases in which electric vehicles just can't perform that function. In which case, are those cases less sensitive to the price of hydrogen than you might expect? Obviously, there's huge error bars between any estimates we put on the hydrogen price when we're looking at TCO. So would a large reduction in hydrogen cost, if we got blue hydrogen off the ground at scale, not make a huge impact on the deployment of hydrogen vehicles in those use cases?
I guess that there was a worst case on that TCO. It actually had a worst case, which is the price of hydrogen at the moment at £23. And it did show a trend that reduced down to £12, which is, I mean, I think we've had quotes lower than that, but we're trying to be pragmatic about, you know, the glide path of hydrogen through the decade. I kind of explained that there's a dead time in there that we've considered within that TCO, but I mean, I did kind of joke about it at the end. I mean, those large vans, ours charges at 150, as a couple of competitors do, a couple at 115. I mean, I drive my BEV all around, and this morning I broke my record. I got it at 79, so that's the fastest charging rate I've seen. If you're charging at 79 or 75, it doesn't take 55 minutes to get to 80%. It takes 110 minutes to get to 80%. So that's a best case scenario for a public charge BEV on there. And actually, realistically, it's probably a lot worse because of the charging time and the lack of infrastructure at the moment. So as hydrogen prices come down, it falls in favour of the TCO argument as well. But I mean, there's, you know, without anything that's double shifted and anything that has high mileage and motorway mileage, it all works better on, and where you need that consistency of range, and you know, we've got fleets that are doing 80,000 miles a year in rural applications, they just can't do that with a BEV. So, you know, there's it's our forecast or our prediction is probably about 35%. The overlap between a diesel large vehicle and a BEV is about 65% only. So there's a 35% gap in operational requirements. Some of that will be hydrogen, but some of that will just have to be compromised as well to find, you know, to change the cycle and do something.
I'll answer that. Our dual fuel technology for hydrogen, right, keeps all the other costs the same for the vehicle, but they're paying a fairly small percentage to enable us to put expensive hydrogen tanks on the vehicle. And at the moment, the reason why they will do that is because they want to deliver their net zero targets, and therefore their business case is paying a little bit more by the time you take the account of that extra cost. And if you have competitive price diesel, then that's the price for their net zero targets. The evidence says in natural gas dual fuel that was trialled in the UK or used in the UK probably about 10 years ago, actually, if you can make the hydrogen cheaper than diesel, then operators will be interested to do that. So the cheaper the hydrogen is, in certainly in our case, the easier my model is to be able to sell to them hydrogen conversion upgrade. We do call it upgrade rather than conversion these days. But so the answer is yes, if the hydrogen price is at the tank significantly cheaper than diesel, or even 20 or 30%, you know, 20% diesel cheaper than diesel, the market will open up hugely in our case.
Thanks everybody for your interaction. We're actually at break now, so we've got half an hour and then we're back with another panel. But thank you everyone for your insights.